Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 633. Now, Kyle, I talk a lot about stuff that I'm promoting, like the Fun Comfortable Tour with dates coming up in Chicago and St. Louis and Boston and New York and Philly and lots of other cities. Go to funcomfortabletour.com. But let's not make this about me, Kyle. We put out the word that if you email your event to events@nerdist.com, then we'll just start using this as a platform to promote stuff that people want to talk about. What do you got on the events page,
well,
Kyle?
Well, I've been tearing through, and I picked three for today that I think are pretty cool. Kyle Crocker was a former skipper on a little boat I like to call the Jungle Cruise.
Did you, first of all, amazing. Second of all, did you just pick him because his first name's Kyle and his last name ends with a C?
It's because I'm obsessed with Disney.
Okay, all right.
And he has a whole podcast called the Jungle Cruise, C-R-E-W-S, where he's talking to old Disney and Jungle Cruise employees and different people who've worked in different parts of the park about what it's like to be an employee at Disneyland and Disney World.
Excellent.
I am super into Disney lore, and like he's had people who like worked there from like the 60s all the way through to now. So it's
all right.
An evolution firsthand.
Great. What else you got?
I got Pontius Rundqvist. I think I'm saying that right, from Sweden. He just completed his first feature film. He started working on it when he was 16.
You don't say.
He's 21 now.
What is that?
And it took him all these years, and his film is called A Real Blues, a Modern Blues Story.
All right.
Sort of a David Lynch, Twin Peaks thing.
And where can people
Sweden.
See it?
It is on his website, which is amodernbluesstory.com.
All right. What else? You said there were three. That
was
two.
And I got my last one is Daniel Imke runs a new show called The Stand-Up Hour in Hotlanta. And the show.
You know, people from Atlanta hate it when outsiders call it
Hotlanta. My girlfriend is from Georgia and gets very upset constantly when I refer to it, which is why I exclusively call it that now.
Okay.
You know, Hotlanta, where How Stuff Works is from. but on the shows, the first one's on February 4th. It's located at the Midtown Tavern and starts at 8:30, and it's a new monthly hour long showcase for all the local acts going to Atlanta. And hey, guy who I've just promoted, I'm coming there in May, so maybe you and I should talk.
Oh, so you want to get stage time?
Maybe.
What if he's like, hey, thanks for the promo. Send me a tape. Like he's got to check out.
Well, then I'll just start disparaging his name.
What?
Don't get evil.
I will unpromote.
Oh my God, Kyle, I've never seen this side of you before.
That's what happens when you come between me and a gig, bro.
That's Kyle Clark with the
with the Clark pages.
Oh God, we're not going to call it the Clark pages. But that's going on in the Nerdist community around the country and around the world right
There's
now.
There's some cool
so
stuff going down.
Check those out, and we'll keep doing this. Events at Nerdist.com with your event. This episode is Pauly Shore, which I worked at the MTV at the same time as Pauly, so I was there for the at the tail end of the of that phenomenon. And
you guys sound like mob dons when you talk, like just
that
back
was
and forth.
How it was.
It's definitely got a mob feel.
But I always really wanted to have a lengthy conversation with him because A, we were at MTV at the same time, and there's just not a lot of us in the world who had that kind of weird experience, weird fun experience. But his was way crazier than mine was, being the, I guess what I'm just going to call the sidekick on Singled Out. But Pauly also his growing up at the Comedy Store. In that period of time,
Jesus Christ,
this whole time I secretly brought him on just to mine him for old Comedy Store stories. I'm like,
tell me more. You could tell the deeper he got into telling Comedy Store stories because all of us just kept leaning closer and closer.
But he continues to be a super sweet guy, and he was very nice to me, Comedy Store is one of those places where I always go, like, I gotta go perform there more. So I want to start performing at the Comedy Store more, I think. It's a good. The Comedy Store is like way come back. Like it's a,
yeah, it sure has.
It's a hot room now.
That roast and battle, man.
He's Pauly has a show on Showtime, a documentary called Pauly Stands Alone. He also started a podcast called Pauly Shore's Interested, which I guess I'll probably do. He asked me to do it, and I guess Marin's been on, and yeah, a bunch of other people have been on. So well, I'll do it. And that's it. So it's Nerds Podcast number 633. Here we go. Katie, start the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Well, please talk to us for an hour now.
So we were talking about our siblings before you got here.
Yeah, we were just talking about not getting along with your siblings.
Do you have a siblings?
I have a half brother, and he's great.
You get along with them?
We get along, yes. Yeah. We share a father, and we get along. But we didn't really grow up together.
Right.
We got close later on in life, and so by that point, we had
maybe
sort of worked
helped
out.
Maybe that helped.
Yeah, we didn't have to grow. We didn't have like the growing pains of kind of crashing into one another as we were developing our personalities.
I was driving over here and I was trying to think of the last time I bumped into you.
I don't know what
it was. Three Arts, right?
If it was, then that would have been probably at least 14 years ago.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, shit.
So
how many siblings do you
have? First of all, I want to say congratulations to him. I haven't, you know, I mean, we come from the same,
yeah,
we come from the same mesh, you
we
know
do.
What I mean?
And you know, I think,
so when did you start at MTV?
94.
94.
And so you were still there, but mm-hmm, it was about the time where you were about to leave.
Yeah, I was there from like 90 to 95.
Right.
Yeah. What did you host?
Single I know.
Oh, you hosted, was that with Jenny?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. I just saw her in, I did see, what did I do? I did her show in
Oh, is she doing a serious?
Yeah,
serious
she does
XM
a serious
show?
Thing yeah. in New York. It was pretty cool.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Everyone, I always found everyone to be very nice. And then the couple of times that I saw you at events, you were very, very sweet to me. And I always felt like, a weird outsider there. Maybe everyone felt this way, but I just felt like I didn't really, I felt like I was sort of, I was trying to force myself into the MTV vibe, and it was very much not my, it wasn't really my, I felt very uncomfortable the whole time
but
I was there.
Yeah, how long did you do Singled Out for?
Almost four years, like 3.5 years.
Yeah, oh, that was a hit show though.
Yeah, it was on.
And was it just you or just Jenny, or was it both you guys?
We were both on, and then Jenny left, and then Carmen Electra took over for a year.
But you had a big run on MTV.
We did, yeah.
No, but you did. Didn't you do like a lot of different things?
I did, but you know, I didn't pop on MTV really because, you know, I don't know. I mean, really, it was like I was just kind of like a
like trying to force yourself,
trying to force myself into this what I thought was supposed to be like, oh, I have to be cool, and I was really just a nerdy kid that was trying to express.
That's why
what
you're
that
on
was.
The Nerdist now.
That's
See,
why
it's,
now
it all makes sense.
It all worked out.
Whoa, bro!
But at the time, I couldn't figure out, like, I just didn't know myself well enough, so I didn't know what my voice was.
Yeah.
And I had to
it is like yeah
enough.
it is a MTV is a very it's a full on, it's like the mafia, especially back then. It was like to try to get in on it,
yeah,
you know, it's just to try to get in on. I mean, I had that same problem when I first started.
Really?
Oh yeah, for sure. I can swear.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. No, I had a really, really difficult time when I first started on MTV. It was, you know, I was nervous. It was live. It was spring break. You know, Corey Feldman was the man.
Uh-huh.
Me and Christian Slater were trying to get laid, and all the girls like Corey Feldman. It was the best. I remember sitting with Christian Slater in my hotel room at the Marriott, and we're going, "This fucking is terrible." Look at
how come everybody's having sex with Corey Feldman?
It's my best.
So, but you know, and then I did a comic thing, a stand up thing, you know, and it did really bad. And then I was doing.
What was the stand up thing?
It was like in a bar or something. It was like a hosting. Remember when they used to do the Young Comedians, or Mario Joyner was hosting it?
Yeah, he did Half Hour Comedy Hour, right?
So it was like that, but it was like at spring break. Oh,
and
wow.
I wasn't ready. Just like you said, you weren't ready.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't feel like I was ready. And then I went back and finally, eventually, you know, did what I did over there.
But. Yeah, because I saw everyone. I saw everyone I thought had a very well-defined voice, character, of all the sort of pantheon of VJs, even going back pretty far. Like, I always loved Kevin Seal because he was always
such an oddball. Yeah, yeah.
And so he was the guy that I gravitated to the most. But when I started working there, it was you and Kennedy and Bill Bellamy and, you know.
Hey, does your audience, I mean, I know your audience right now, do they know you from that time? Or do you even talk about it?
Some people do. Yeah, I don't care what I talk about it, but some people do.
Yeah.
There's people in a certain age range do. And then, you know, years later, I would go to work at G4, which doesn't exist anymore. And people were like,
right.
I watched you back in the day at G4. I'm like, I don't think you know what back in the day is.
Right.
But I never felt, like, I always felt everyone had their own voice. And, you know, yours was certainly one of the strongest. And I just felt like, I'm just a guy. I don't know what
I have
to offer.
But this thing that you have now, I mean, every time I mention people that I'm coming to see you people have really, you know, this is huge for you.
Oh, yeah, it's been fun. It's been fun.
And I talked to your producer, tell me your name again, Katie Levine. Again, and she was telling me that, that you know, you were one of the first ones to kind of break on, and you were your consistency 4 or 5 years doing this.
Yeah, this is our fifth year.
That's sick, man.
But it was just sort of an interesting lesson of trying to fit into other people's thing and then going, I'm just going to do my own thing that I'm comfortable with. But it took a long time to figure that out.
Right. Well, that's what the internet and this whole world has been able to do right? And for me, I'm kind of like 10 steps back. I'm like, oh shit, I got to tweet. You know what I mean? I got to do all this stuff. And I'm like, all right, I'll do it. So now I'm kind of doing it. And I'm kind of like, I don't want to say I'm late in the game, you know, hopping on this whole world. I've been doing a podcast for about, I don't know, 4 months now. It's been going good. And then we're moving over to Podcast One.
Okay, cool.
Which Norm says, what's up?
Yeah, tell Norm I said hello.
Yeah, for sure. And so it's, you know, it's similar to the old shit we used to do back in the day, you know, interviewing people, talking to people, you know, getting into people. So I kind of did that already back when I was on MTV.
There are so many things that I want to ask you about. I mean, first of all, your lineage is such a treasure trove for a comedy nerd. Like, I am, let's going back even farther before MTV, did you literally grow up in the Comedy Store?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I talk about it when I go on stage because, like, I still perform there, you know. I go on stage there, and, you know, I come out and the first thing I say, not always, but most of the time, the first thing I say is, like, I've been here since I was 4.
Jesus.
You know what I mean? Like, I know Louis C.K., he filmed his last special there probably about a week or two ago, and I was backstage with him, and he was telling me, like, we were in the backstage and we were staring at the stage, you know, from kind of the comics point of view, and he told me that, you know, that Chris Rock had taken him to go see George Carlin in this room, and Louis C.K. is like, yo, I got to do a fucking special here, and he did the special here. And then I was telling him, like, you gotta understand, like, I've been there since I was 4, so I remember, like, Buddy Rich.
Oh, wow.
Buddy Rich, my mom used to have him. My mom was fucking awesome, dude. I mean, she's still alive, she's not well, but back at the time, she was fucking just amazing. I mean, the Comedy Store was, like, it's still doing really well. You know, the comedy boom is, like, it's out there, like, the other night it was like me, Snyder, Robert Snyder, you know, I think Chris D'Elia, like Sebastian, like boom, 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 boom. And the main room was electrifying, and it was a really great, great show. But it just definitely wasn't like it was back when I was younger. Like when Robin Williams was there and Eddie Murphy was there and Dice was there and
Richard Pryor
was there and all those guys were there. So it's just different. It's just the same thing with music, I think, you know, like the Rolling Stones.
But there was a specific time period. I mean, like that club came on at the perfect time for that comedy boom that started in the 70s and then went into the 80s. So it was like,
You had Red Fox. Red Fox was really funny, dude. Like, really funny stand-up. He was so funny.
Of course I remember Red Fox.
But his stand-up was so funny.
And filthy. Like,
yeah,
was pretty
really
filthy.
Dirty. Yeah.
So you hung out at the club when you were 4. You were just running around the club.
Well, my parents divorced when I was 3. My mom got the Comedy Store where they started it in 72. So my dad was out on the road. He was like touring with Elvis Presley. You know, my dad would my dad opened for like the biggest acts ever, like Sammy Davis and who else? I don't know, Sid Caesar and Milton Berle. You know, they used to go to the Friars Club in Beverly Hills. Wow. That's where they used to hang out. So my mom was at the Comedy Store, and she was starting her second life, which was divorced with the Comedy Store at 40 years old.
Oh, wow.
So that's when my mom really started. And I have four brothers, or four siblings all together. So my mom had that shit before she was 40. I was the last one. So the second part of her life was when she was 40, and she was all about, like, the store. You know what I mean? Like, developing acts. Like, you know, she told Roseanne to wear suspenders. You know what I mean? Shit like that. You got to put the suspenders on.
Listen, if we know Roseanne for anything, it's the suspenders
it
that
is.
She wears.
It's true, yeah. And Gallagher used to fucking sneak into my house and fuck my mom's assistant and shit like that. Yeah. You know what I mean? But all so that weird. Shit, like, you know what I mean? Like,
You look in the room, it's just watermelon.
And it's funny because
all over the fuck was Gallagher here? Because there's fucking melon rinds.
Yeah. But, you know, and Robin, when Robin died, it really affected me because he was like a really close friend to the family and close to the Comedy Store. And it was like, you know, as a kid, I remember him, you know, my mom nurturing him and bringing him up and stuff like that, you know, before Mork and Mindy and all that.
I mean, I would guess that you've probably lost a ton of people that are, I mean,
yeah,
Kinnison.
Yeah, Sam. Yeah. Yeah, I was, you know, it's fucked up, man, because, like, you know, you're all of a sudden you're in that world, and all of a sudden now we're older, and now we're looking back on that world. And it's like, whoa, you know? It's crazy.
Why do you... Well, especially in the 70s and 80s, too. Like, that was the drug culture was so insane. And it was so closely tied to comedy.
And what's fucked up to me just about our business now is you can't do anything. You know what I mean? Because we're always being watched now. It's not cool, dude. Like, you can't... You know what I mean? Like, for real, dude. Like, if I feel like everywhere I go, like, I can't really be... I don't want to say a scumbag.
Right.
You know, you can't... Fuck around. You got to be mind your P's and Q's on everything.
I want to know, like, just any. First of all, everyone says the Comedy Store is because it was Ciro's.
Right.
And everyone's like, it's really creepy late at night, and there's.
I never saw any ghosts.
Bullshit. Yeah. You saw ghosts.
No, Matt wants to believe that there are ghosts. No,
I never saw. Yeah, I never.
You know, when I first. I went to UCLA. And I did comedy a little bit when I was in a club at UCLA where we did helped each other write, and we did stand up a few times a year. But the first time,
where are you from originally?
I was born in Kentucky. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee.
Wow, were you? I was just in Lexington.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Different comedy off Broadway.
I haven't been there. I'm from Louisville, but I mean I was born in Louisville. But
why don't you talk like this, man?
Well, I don't
What's
know.
What's going on, dude?
I shit it somewhere
Come
along
on,
the way.
Oh, goddamn. Okay, sorry.
But when I started doing stand up again full time in '98. The Belly Room was the first place that I performed.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was a bringer show.
Was Falstaff there?
No, it was just a bringer show. It was, what was her name? It was a woman named Bobby Shropshire. She ran this weekly bringer show, and that was the first place that I went up when I decided, like, okay, I'm going to do this full time now. And but I have to say, for a long time, the vibe of the store really scared me because it... And it shouldn't have.
It remind you of MTV, right? Trying to get in, bro. It's like, you know. No.
Well, sort of in a weird way. It's just that there was a very specific vibe there for a long time. And I think it was born out of this, almost like this evolutionary thing of having to battle with weird late night shows. Mm. And just like some of the weird people that would come in and be in the audience. Mm. And you'd be in a room of like 9 or 10 people. And it was a real... And, you know, a lot of people really developed amazing skill sets, like
based on that.
Yeah, if you could, like, if you could survive at this, if you could survive at the store for a while, like, you were relatively bulletproof,
right?
At that point,
yeah. No, it's still that way. I mean, it still has that, you know, where there's the comics are in the audience, and you know, like on the Monday, I think Monday nights is open mic night.
Is that the 40 comics and like?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's got that vibe. But now, I mean, you're obviously very welcome to come if you want to do a set anytime.
Oh, I'd love to.
I mean, it's always open to you.
Oh, I appreciate that.
You know, people would really like to see you up there, and it's a great lineup tonight. Mark Maron, D'Elia, Rogan. It's like,
are they in the main room or in the OR?
OR.
Nice.
Yeah, they just go up. Everyone wants to go on stage. You know what I mean? David Spade's coming in now a lot, so it's like Chris Rock was there like two nights ago.
There's not a ton of places to. There's not a ton of reliable places to do stand up in Los Angeles. It's not a great. It's not a great stand up town.
To me, seems weird. Like that energy, like that corner. It's always like packed and.
Well, the light. You know, the lights are usually on. Yeah. Like the lights in the audience are up.
Oh, really? I
and
don't
so
like
it's,
that.
It yeah. can be a little like you're yeah. in a conference room, and yeah. it's a little. And I always.
I like it dark in the audience.
It should be dark yeah. in the audience, and I always found. You know, the last couple times I went to the Laugh Factory, I got bumped by an hour and a half because of Dane. Mm. And then I went up at like 1:15.
Dane Cook Factory.
Yeah, I went up at like 1:15 in the morning, and there were like 10 people left. And I was like, I don't need to do this.
I like to play a fun game when I'm driving up Sunset, which is to guess who's on the marquee before I get there.
Oh, wow.
And it's, I always go like, Dane Cook, Tony Rock.
Right, exactly.
It's going to be Dom Irrera.
Dom, I love Dom.
It's going to be Tim Allen's Wednesday show. And
could
then I
be Tim.
And I'm like, I nail it almost every time. Yeah. I can do it with the store,
so do
too.
So do you work out in L.A.?
I do usually at our, you know, we have a little,
oh, yeah,
we have a tiny
thing.
Little room at the back of a comic book store, but I would,
you
I
should come to the OR, dude.
I'd love to
get you a spot. You know, I know the owner.
That's great. And,
no, I get you a spot. If you want to text me, I'll hook you up with
sure.
Adam, the manager there. Just text
That'd
him.
That'd be great.
If you want to call in like on Mondays and say, hey, I want to pop in, but
that'd
it's
be awesome.
Great. And all you have to do is 10 or 15 minutes. So,
that's
you know,
perfect.
Yeah, so you just do a set.
That's perfect.
And it's a really cool vibe.
So
Ari Shaffir just shot his Comedy Central special there.
Ari's great.
Yeah, so he's really blowing up. So
that's fantastic. You know,
he won't return my call, that cocksucker.
What?
No, I'm just kidding.
What? Did you have any concept when you were 4 years old, like that? Because it's, you know, I grew up in a bowling center. My dad owned a bowling center.
In Louisville.
In Memphis.
Memphis.
Yeah, in Memphis, Tennessee.
Do you ever go to the Memphis Elvis Presley thing?
Yeah, Graceland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sick.
I didn't go there until much later in life. Because I think when I grew up there, I was like, ah, who cares?
Can you believe how real it is?
It's
so weird.
It's a very strange, yeah. It's eerie. Yeah. Graceland is eerie.
It is.
But just sort of growing up in an unconventional environment, I don't think I had any concept when I was a kid. Like, oh, this is not normal. This is like a normal life.
Mm.
What was your life like when you were, you know, when your mom is basically single mom, you know, establishing this business, and then you're a kid running around? Like, were you raised?
I was like a hot potato, pretty much. You know what I mean? Like, my mom would be busy, and she'd just kind of hand me to one comic, and then the other comic would hand me to another comic, and the other comic would hand me to another comic. And it was pretty much like that.
Who was the best babysitter comic?
I'd have to say this guy, Chris Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Jackson was like best friends with Eddie Murphy. And he played Winnie the Pooh at Disneyland also besides doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
So he would, you know, do the stand-up thing and then kind of babysit me. And then like during the day, he would go to Disneyland and play Winnie the Pooh. And he took me.
I mean, that's a pretty good babysitter.
Yeah, he took me a lot. Me and my friends would go, and you know, we'd speak through the thing to say what's up to him. And you know what I mean? I'll meet you at the thing. All right, I'll see you at 6.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So he was really cool. I don't know who else. I mean, you know, you had Mike Binder. You know Mike Binder?
Yeah, I know Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really know him, but I know who he is.
Yeah, he was a great comedian and director. He's a director now. Howie Mandel, you know, Jim Carrey, all these guys were there.
Yeah.
Dice, Paul Rodriguez.
What was the scene? What did it feel like to be there in the late 70s, early 80s? Like,
it was like heaven. It was kind of like when I got on my MTV, you know, when I got that time, it was like heaven. I was like Willy Wonka. I was like, oh my God, I'm like right out of high school. You know what I mean? I started acting and stuff, and then I got in comedy, and then I got on MTV.
Did you audition for MTV?
Pretty much, yeah. Not like a VJ type thing.
So how did they – was it an open audition, or were you connected through the Comedy Store in some way?
No, they just saw me. Drew Wilson. You remember Drew Wilson?
Yeah.
She was the head of talent back then?
Kind of, yeah.
She was like South African lady.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. She was great. She saw me at the store. She thought I did really well. They flew me down to spring break. That didn't go well. And then I went back, and then I did a comic strip live, which was from the Laugh Factory, and that was a Fox show, and I did really well on that. And then we took that tape to MTV, and that like blew them away. And then from there, we started doing commercials. Remember Randy the Redwoods?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, so I did like my own kind of version of that.
That was the image campaign department.
Yeah. So I did that. And then after that, they offered me like a month called Totally Polly, because the image campaign thing would say Totally MTV at the end.
Right.
And then from there, I got on Totally Polly. So it was like slowly. It wasn't like, here's a 3-year contract. It wasn't like that. It was just like little pieces, and everything kind of took off.
Now, how did you, without, I know this is a fucking stupid question, but without the aid of social media, how, at that time, how was the network gauging, this character is catching on and people.
Well, it wasn't really a character. It was kind of who I was. It wasn't like Pee Wee Herman.
Right.
You know what I mean? I was pretty much like that. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? I dressed that way and I acted that way. It wasn't like, you know what I mean?
So for you, it wasn't like finding this voice. It was just you just kind of being yourself.
The whole thing happened accidentally. You know what I mean? When I was at the video, check it out. It's major, bro. Oh, you know what I mean? And that shit happened like just accidentally. And then we watched it back and we're like, it's fucking hysterical. You know what I mean? And it turned out like that. But they didn't watch me because I had my own language. I spoke my own thing to the kids. You know, check out my wood you created, bro. And I had my own shtick at the time that was speaking right to the kids. And the kids were very much connected to it. And it's weird because even to this day, you know, here I am fucking 46 and it's still like, you know, I go through airports, yo, bro, you know, the shit like that. And it's like, this guy's like 50 yelling that shit to me.
Well, but, you know, MTV,
was so big back then.
Yeah, I mean, it's, if people were in a certain age group, that, especially at that time, that's what you watched. You watched MTV, and it was incredibly influential over, like, it was so culturally influential over, you know, and I was the right age for that, too. So going to work there completely flipped me out because I was like, holy shit, remote control was here.
Right, yeah.
You and all these other people and, you know, they ran the Young Ones and, like, MTV was really cool. It was a cool channel.
Yeah, and you know, even to this day, like, you know.
Say the two old men reminiscing. It was cooler in those days.
But no, even to this day, you know, like, when I bump into Bobby Moore and Tony DeSanto and.
Oh, yeah, Tony.
And Tim Healy. These guys are my, like, friends. I still talk to them all the time, you know, and that's because that's my college. I went from high school to MTV to films. I didn't go to college. So that was my college. Those were my college years. And when you're in college, you're what, fucking 19 to what, 24, 25, 20, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So those years were the years, you know, that was my frat. You know what I mean? Those spring breaks were like insane.
I never, by the way, just side note for Matt, Tony DeSanto was the guy who created Unplugged. He was a producer at MTV. He created Unplugged.
A lot of shows. And he was my assistant.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
I like Tony. He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's cool. Fuck Tony.
Why would you say that? He's nice. So what, you know, for me, the spring break experience was very, it was very clinical. Like they would go, okay, if you have to shoot on this day, then we're going to fly you in that morning if we can. If not, then we'll fly you in late the night before. Like, they did not, I felt like they didn't want you there any longer than you absolutely, because they didn't have to pay for you to be there.
Yeah. Well, so they didn't spend a lot of money.
I didn't really, like, the spring breaks for me weren't really that fun in terms of, like, being social, because there just wasn't any, it was like, oh, I got to go now.
Yeah, in and out. Yeah.
I suspect it might have been a little more fun. I think it had started to get way more corporate-y when I was there, when I started there in, like, 94, 95, because I would hear these stories about, like, oh, the first beach house was fucking crazy.
Yeah.
People jumping off roofs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now there's liability and the neighbors.
Yeah, 100%.
And we can't. So
100%.
Like, there was a generation before me
that
had all the MTV fun. But for me, it was not, it was very like, you know, do this, stand here, get out.
If the Tiki God talks to you, don't talk back.
The Tiki God, that guy was a guy named Andy McElfrish, and he worked on Leno for years and years and years.
Andy McElfrish hosts Edumacation Andy with Kevin Smith on the Smodco Network.
Andy, I made him do my outgoing message once, as the Tiki God. So at what point, did you feel comfortable the whole time at MTV? Were you like, did you Did you enjoy it as a paradise, or did it get it ever feel weird to you?
At the beginning, it was weird, you know, until I got my ratings and until, like, they started asking me to do more shit and I got my confidence and I felt more comfortable. Then it was like I was in heaven.
At the beginning, it was Paradise City. At the end, it was Gangsta's Paradise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because it probably seemed like, oh, wow, this is... I'm guessing it seemed that, oh, this is super easy. I just have to be myself and fuck around, and amazing things happen around that.
It's just connecting with that audience, you know? I just somehow connected with them with whatever it was that I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, and it worked, and it caught on, and it parlayed me into all my films.
Right.
What did you want to do when you were... When you were in high school, having grown up around the store, were you just like comic, comic, comic?
No, I mean, I mean, I know it's going to sound stupid, but I miss acting. You know, I acted a lot. You know, even before MTV, I was just acting. I did like 21 Jump Street. I did St. Elsewhere. I was just acting, and I miss acting. I remember meeting Johnny Depp when I did 21 Jump Street, and I was like, fucking, I knew this guy was going to be a big star. I just knew it. You know what I mean? I hung out with him, and. And yeah, he plays music and shit, but he was like a star. He's like a movie star. Like, I knew it. And, you know, I wanted to do what he was doing, you know, and I felt like that's where I was going. I felt like, you know, if I can just keep acting, you know what I mean? Then, you know, I can act. But then the MTV thing happened, which was awesome and also fucked at the same time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it kind of threw you off course a little bit. Yeah.
Well, not only did it throw you off course, but it made you so identifiable as this, guy that. And especially that time, you know, things are different now. Like, there's so many things cross over now, and people can be on a movie, and they can be in a television show, they can do this, they can do that. But at the time, especially, I'm sure it was probably like, oh, no, that guy just does that thing. Mm. He can't. Why? No, he's that guy.
And even then, too, it was the whole, like, you do TV. You don't do movies. You do TV.
Right.
Well,
100%.
He did cross over. He crossed over.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm sure it was a bit of more of a struggle, whereas they're like seeing him as TV guy, TV guy, TV guy, and he's like, no, I can do a movie.
I think it was more...
I mean, we could ask him. Polly?
No, hang on. Because I think even though you said it was you, but the character of Polly Shore, I would imagine, would have been constrictive in terms... Not television or film. I think the character might have been constrictive. Did you feel like that?
As far as...
Doing other things and going back and doing other acting. Yeah.
Yeah, especially after Encino Man and Son-in-Law.
Right.
I mean, those are big hits for me. And that put the stamp on it. That's who this guy is.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I was on MTV every day and starring in films and doing HBO specials at the same time. So it was like so, so much. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, it was like so, so much.
Were you ever worried, like, ah, fuck?
I wasn't thinking about that, dude. I was 20 fucking...
What were the parties like?
Yeah, exactly. I was just having fun, and I just loved acting, and I loved starring in films, and I love rewriting scripts with the writers, and I love waking up early and ordering a fucking breakfast burrito from the fucking, you know, the catering guy. Oh, give me an egg white breakfast burrito, bro. You know what I mean? And then going to my shit, and then I love when they would call us to the set to, like, rehearse, and then we would block the scene. You know, I miss all that shit. You know what I mean?
And so when did you start to feel like, oh, maybe this isn't working as much anymore?
Probably after Biodome.
Right.
You know what I mean? After Biodome didn't perform. It's really about what it does at the box office. You know what I mean? And you know, even though Biodome to this day, you know, a lot of your audience probably knows that film and probably really liked it. It did really well for me as a cult film.
Right.
Like, fucking, like, I know this because when I tour... You get a response from the crowd when you mention certain things. But after that movie, it was just like my jig was up. It was like, you know, I had this great run and now it's time to go away.
I had actually auditioned for Biodome.
Really?
I think I auditioned.
To play William Atherton?
Yep.
Really?
I lost so many parts. No. to the Baldwin, to Stephen Baldwin.
Oh, wow.
And my girlfriend's mom was in Biodome.
Wow.
It turns out.
Patty Hearst?
Yeah.
Patty Hearst?
Yeah.
That's your girlfriend?
That's my girlfriend's mom.
Oh, wait. Oh, who's your girlfriend?
Lydia Hearst.
Oh, okay. She's oh, Lydia. Okay, I know Lydia. Yeah. Every time I see her, she's always like, right? Patty Hearst.
Yeah.
That's the mom.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
Holy shit.
Because I told her, I was like, oh, Polly's on the show. She's like, my mom is in Biodome. I'm like, what?
That's crazy.
I totally forgot that.
You know what's crazy also is that I get on Twitter, I get people hitting me up going, I didn't know Tenacious D was in Biodome. Jack Black's in Biodome.
Yep.
Yeah, he was in there. And that's when he first started.
So after Biodome, what do you think happened? Do you think it was just one too many... poly things, and people were like,
yeah, and also the quality, I think, you know what I mean, wasn't as good. I think the directors weren't as good. I think the scripts weren't as good. I just think everything wasn't as good, you know,
because
I
was under the Breakfast Burritos is good?
Yeah. No, I was under the umbrella at Disney of Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Okay.
Genius. He's a fucking genius. Like, yeah. He was like the only, like, from what my experience, like, when I worked in the business, like, he was the only guy that was like this big executive, but also would love to get his hands dirty in the script,
mm-hmm.
and like really be creative. You know, a lot of these suits are like, oh, let them do it. But he got into it. And that's why all those three movies, Encino Man, Son-in-Law, and Biodome were big hits for me. No, not Biodome. In the Army Now was a big hit for me. Those three films, because Jeffrey Katzenberg oversaw everything. And then after I left Disney, I did...
Didn't Jury Duty?
Jury Duty was over at... That was at Sony.
Okay.
That was at Sony, and then Biodome was MGM.
Okay.
But so that's where I think like the quality after In the Army Now, I think, wasn't as good. You know, because those three films that I did were really successful.
And then when you started to feel like, oh, the usual stuff's not working, what do you do? Do you ignore it, or do you try to fix it, or like what, how do you deal with it?
Well, I did a sitcom.
Yeah.
I did a sitcom on Fox, and that got canceled, you know, which happens a lot.
It happens more often than.
Yeah.
You know, every sitcom that's been on Fox, except for the ones on right now, got canceled.
Yeah.
That's very true.
That's true.
Oh, well, you're blowing my mind.
You son of a bitch. So after that, I felt like tired, and I felt burnt. And I felt like I needed a break, and I let my manager and my agent go at the time, you know, which I think was a bad move. But I didn't do it, you know, because they did anything. I just kind of needed to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just wanted to get away from CAA and Three Arts and that whole thing. I just needed to kind of be alone. I needed to kind of grow up. For so long, I'd been kind of spoon-fed. You know, I went from... You know, growing up with, in Beverly Hills, I went to Beverly Hills High School. My mom gave me whatever I wanted. And then I went from, you know, from that to like MTV, and they gave me whatever I wanted. And then I went from that to movies and Playboy Mansion, and they gave me whatever I wanted. And I was just everything I wanted. And then finally, people stopped giving me what I wanted. And I was kind of like, you know, now I'm like everyone else. And I felt like more, I think Marc Maron even said that like in a LA Times piece I did recently. He's like, yeah, when life started shitting on him, that's when he got funnier. You know what I mean? I don't know. I think I read that. But it was a blast. You know, I had such a good time. And you know, and my 30s were a little rough because I was just, you know, I needed to get away from everything. I needed to kind of go from a boy to a man. Like, I remember my 30th birthday party, I cried. I like, cried a lot because it was just weird. And it wasn't about the career. It was about, like, what was going on inside of me. I was, like, going from, like, this childlike person to, like, a human being. And it was, like, and I didn't know how to do it.
Well,
so now my 30s were, like...
Well, sure. It must have been scary, know, too, yeah. Because you don't know what... You don't know... Nothing's being fed to you. Like, you're not being spoon-fed anymore. You don't know what is going to happen with the future. And you're probably... I'm sure it's a massive identity crisis. You're like, oh, this thing that I was for so long is not a thing. I mean, like, but it's me, and it's not. I don't know how to process that.
Yeah, it was really hard. You know, I got sad. You know, I got really sad. I lost my smile. I was depressed. And that's when I did Pauly Shore's Dead, you know, after that. But fortunately, knock on wood, that I never went and did crazy drugs. I was never had that. I don't have that addiction, you know, mm-hmm. that a lot of people have when things don't work out for them. I was able to, I saved my money. I still have a beautiful house up in the hills, and you know, I live in Silver Lake, but you know, I have a house. I still own my house, and I lease it out and stuff like that. But I was able to, just kind of like, you know, grow up from the whole thing.
At any point in that during that time, did you think, you know, maybe I'm just going to audition for other things and not be Pauly Shore. I'm going to audition and just be like, go back to doing episodic television or movies just as an actor.
Yeah, I mean, I did too. I mean, I don't remember, but I did a lot. I've done a lot of different things. You know, I just don't remember what they were, like a lot of different parts and different things here and there.
Yeah.
So.
And were you continuing to do stand up that whole the whole time during the whole period?
But I started when I did. I talk about Pauly Shore's Dead. Okay, which is something that I was one of the first people to shoot HD. you know, with the first. It was like 2000, 2001.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had like a, that's it was early. Like a 1080i camera, and I was like, I was on the cover of the HD magazine directing this, you know what I mean? But I paid for it, and I directed it, and I wrote it, and I got everyone in it, and everyone got the joke. And it turned out to be like one of my best things. And ever since then, you know, I've been just producing and directing and acting and putting my own money in my own stuff, and I own everything. And just this last film that I did, my documentary, has been like just beautifully.
The Showtime documentary. Yeah,
People have just beautifully responded to it. So, you know, from specials, you know, I have a deal at Showtime where I just kind of do stuff with them, and they trust me, and my stuff gets out there. And I don't know, you know, everything happens for a reason. You know, it's like, you know, because of, you know, shit slowing down for me, I kind of got, I got up off the bike, and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to do this myself. And I did it myself. And now here we are, 2015, and everyone's what? Doing it themselves.
Right.
So I have this experience, you know, I have a C300 camera. I'm, you know, doing this stuff, what you're doing. And so, you know, I'm able to, you know, put stuff together from scratch, you know, which I wouldn't have been able to done if shit didn't slow down. Cause I wouldn't have had that experience.
What do you think is the a common misconception about you, like what this, what do you think people perceive you to be?
I think people just feel annoyed by my character or by that whole weasel shit, which I think is fucking awesome.
You think it's awesome? They're annoyed by it, or you think the
character? I think that weasel character is awesome.
Yeah,
it's silly. Like, who does silly shit anymore? Everyone's so serious,
right?
You know what I mean? It's cool to be stupid. You know what I mean? Like, I was with this girl like recently, and we were out like just having dinner. She's a friend of mine. It wasn't like anything romantic or anything, and you know, and she says like, I like you when you're just being you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, fuck, is it like that annoying to have goof off?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, what, I can't goof off? Is that not cool anymore?
No,
because that's really what the weasel is, being stupid and goofy.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think I've heard yeah. I've heard, you know, I've had people say that to me before, and I've calmed down a lot in the last couple of years, because I used to be super like spazzy, and I think it was just a defense mechanism or a way to try to like, hey guys, everything's okay, let's all you know, everything's, and then and when I stopped trying to do stuff is when.
But isn't that weird? Like, you can't be stupid, otherwise people are like, you're acting stupid. And it's not cool, you know?
I don't know. You got to find someone who lets you act stupid around them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's also nice when someone says, hey, I like you when you're just yourself.
Yeah.
And because I think there are times and places to be stupid, and other times, I think the thing about being stupid is that it can, if the other person's up for it, it's fine, but it can create work for the other person, because then they have to be stupid too, or they have to be like, you're forcing them to engage in this charade of like, and sometimes that's fine. Other times I think people are just like, hey, why don't we just talk? Like, why can't we just be normal?
That's cool too. So I find myself like, you know, shifting a lot into just talking, and I'm like, all right, now I got to talk. But I guess it's okay. I mean, like I was saying about the documentary, is like, I got that a lot from people, even close friends that would text me, or, you know, I don't know, David Arquette, you know, he called me or texted me and said, oh my God, like, you know what I mean? And these people didn't like hit me up like when I did Adopted.
Right.
You know, I would go do the movie in Africa where I adopted black babies, which was a mockumentary, which was, to me, I thought was really funny, but it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they like the stuff that's really, people like the stuff that's really true.
Well, I think, you know, I think. It's interesting to hear, you know, because the audiences get such a one-dimensional side of what they see on a screen, or like what a person's character,
and
what they perceive as a person's character.
And sometimes there's nothing wrong with that. Like, what did Eminem say? Like, I think of Eminem a lot because I think he's fucking genius. Like, with his thing is like, you know, like, what does he say? He says that one rap, I am whatever it is that you say that I am. You know how, like, he's like, oh, he's nuts. He's got Slim Shady. He's got Marshall Mathers. He's got all these different personalities. Like, he's just fucking around.
Yeah.
And, like, that's all I was really doing, is just fucking around.
Yeah. And I think people just like seeing a human. I think they're totally fine with that fucking around stuff. But I think sometimes they just like seeing.
That's more relatable.
A human connection. Yeah. Because there's so much stuff now that people are constantly having to process, and there's a million, you know, like when we were growing up, again, I mean, like, it was pre-internet, MTV was really the place for that kind of alternative, younger mindset. And now it's everywhere. And like it's just everywhere. it's so much everywhere that I think people really like to have, like, they've seen the one-dimensional stuff and they just kind of like the, I think they like the sort of the human connection of things. And I think people, you know, I mean, you're the way that you grew up and the environment that you were surrounded in. I mean, the most influential, brilliant, tragic stories in comedy swirled around, like, that was part of your life. That's beyond fascinating.
Yeah. That's who I am. You know?
Who do you think you were most influenced by at the
I'd have to say Richard Pryor and Sam Kennison. That the what I really learned from them a lot, because I saw them live a lot, was how likable they were on stage. You know what I mean? How they would go on stage and immediately you just feel their heart. And I think that was like the most thing. And when it came to hecklers, it was never like mean. They were never like, you know, like mean. It was always like kill them with kindness. And I kind of got that from them, you know, that thing, you know. So, you know what I mean?
Did you ever see them, like, what was it like to watch one of them have a rough set?
Well, the way, I mean, let's talk about Richard Pryor first. He had a lot of rough sets because the way he would work his hour, you know, you've seen Live on the Sunset Strip.
Yeah, of course.
You've seen those older comedy movies. He would basically go up in the OR, and I was there, I saw it happen. Because I would be like, how the fuck is this guy going to pull this hour off? He's got, you know, Columbia Pictures or whoever. Like, he's got to deliver an hour in, like, 3 months or 2 months or whatever it was. And he would literally go up every night, and he would start off with 5 minutes, and it would, like, tank. And then he would go up with 6 minutes, and it would get a little bit better. And then finally, like, within, like, 2 weeks or 3 weeks, he had, like, a good 20 minutes.
Wow.
You know, and it just, that was how he worked. He's just like a little start, a little kernel, but he was there every night at like nine, blah, 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 whatever the time was. And, you know, and he just did it. You know what I mean? But I watched him bomb a lot. He bombed a lot. People were like, this ain't going to be funny. Even though when he'd walk on, up on stage, people were like, this is Jesus Christ.
Right.
People like, even to this day, like, if, you know, like, if anyone, any big comics go on stage now, like, they, people, the audience doesn't respond as they did when Richard Pryor was name was mentioned. People couldn't believe it. You know, ladies and gentlemen, Richard Pryor would be like, oh my God, what? And people would stand up and then he'd walk on stage and your heart would just open. And it was like this really sweet, sweet experience that he would have. And he was so funny, dude. You know, he was so funny.
What about Sam?
His sets were like, I mean, he was so funny because, like, you know, before, you know, the drugs and before that, you know, he got so affected and became that character, you know, he was just, like, dangerous and you didn't know what the fuck he was going to say. And he would go on stage and he was just, like, this guy, this ex-preacher guy that was, that just, you know, you could see he went against the ministry. You could see, like, he broke out and now he's going to fuck with them.
Right.
You know what I mean? He's like... he got away from us and now he's gonna uncover us. And he had that thing and now he started talking about the ministry and Jesus and all these different, and it was hysterical. And it was like taboo. You know, he would talk about taboo and I was a short order cook at the Comedy Store in Westwood when I was 14 years old. And Sam used to come, you know, all the comics, Jimmy Brogan, Kerry Snow, they all used to come back there and I'd give him my leftovers. I'd give Sam the leftovers. My mom used to put Sam on last. He would go on last and he would go on stage and it'd be around 2 a.m. It'd probably be about, I don't know, 6 to 10 people in the audience. And he would take the stool and he would do a couple of his jokes. And then he'd be like, out of my house, get out of my house. And he would take the stool and he would throw it at the kids because it was by UCLA.
Yeah.
And all the kids would like scamper off. and then I would feed him and then he would sleep on the stage.
Oh my God.
Because he had nowhere to stay. And I would leave the door open for him, you know, at the end of the night.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And he was... dangerous and lovable and hysterically funny, and you know, and I was in awe of him because he was unattractive physically, but he was so attractive and so sexy at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think
does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Did did you think success destroyed some of these people? I mean, obviously, Sam died in a way that was terrible, that had nothing to do
with... But at the beginning?
But, well, but what did you learn about success watching, you know, Sam Kinison sleeping on the stage, and then a couple years later, he's, like, the biggest fucking comic in, you know, in the country?
No, it was just about talent. He was talented, and everyone knew it. So it was just a matter of time. Just like Jim Carrey. You know, I watched him, and he was fucking so talented, but also terrible at the same time, like... trying to figure it out. You know, when you do his, like, his impressions of, like, who is it, Henry Fonda on Golden Pond.
Yeah.
You know, remember that?
Yeah.
You know,
oh,
he
yeah.
would, like, turn around, and he fucking was fucking Henry Fonda. You were like, this guy is fucking amazing. And he didn't hit for a while. He did some really bad films, like Once Bitten.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He did some, like, really shitty films. But then once he got on, you know, obviously, was it Living Color?
Yeah.
And he was able to kind of do these characters. That's who Jim was. And then that's why Ace Ventura worked for him, because he was playing this kind of odd character.
I just mean success. Yeah. Like, what did you learn about watching the trappings of success, or any, you know, like, were there lessons that you were learning in throughout this process and go, oh, wow, that was really fucked up. I have to remember not to do that.
100%. I mean, I have this saying that I came up with a long time ago, which is, it's cool to dance with the devil, just don't become the devil, which means it's cool to get fucked up, but just don't become fucked up.
Right.
And, you know, and that's what happened to Amy Winehouse. That's what happened to a lot of these people. They get successful and their addiction takes over them and they become this fucking just mess. And Sam became a mess. He was a fucking disaster.
And is there any way, you know, I'm sure there are, you know, people like, oh, I wish I had done this, or can you help someone in that, at that stage? Like,
I mean, look at Andy Dick, you know what I mean? I talk about him a lot right now because I'm concerned for him.
Yeah.
Because I love Andy Dick in America, and people think he's fucking hysterical, but he's got this addiction thing. Like, you know, it's just an addiction thing. I mean, we have AA meetings at the Comedy Store. There's people there. Like, I don't know. I can't answer what that is like, you know, to be that. So I think that's just addiction. You got to be sober.
And I think you also have to be lucky enough to have people in your life that you trust that can go, hey, you need to come back because you're about to fall off the cliff.
Yeah, but when you're fucked up, from what I understand, like, you know, it's like, it's the old saying, you can lead a horse to water. You know what I mean? Like, right? You can't make him do coke.
You can't. No, the horses will do all the coke in the room. Like, right. A horse will do... They have noses for coke. A horse...
They sure do, yeah. Huge nostrils, Chris.
But...
does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Sam had all these people around him, and he was making money, and he was touring, and, you know, it got to the time where United Artists... You know, he sued, like, United Artists over, like, this script called A Took.
Mm-hmm.
Sam was going to star in a movie where he played, like, an Eskimo or some shit, and he showed up with his tour bus. He's, like, on the set. Imagine if you committed to a film that's mm-hmm. starring you. It's a $10 million budget, and you go to fucking, like, Texas or whatever, right? And you're and everyone's there, the craft service, the burritos are there, right?
Nice.
and you haven't even read the script. You haven't even read the script, right? And all his comedians that are all on coke, they all read the script. They're like, this thing sucks. And the bus drives off. And he's like, I'm not doing this piece of shit.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so he got sued by United Artists for, like, you know, $10 million or $20, whatever it was. So he had to, like, tour to pay off the attorneys and da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't...
So he made some really bad choices.
Well, you know, I think the party stuff is... fun in the beginning because everything's a lot easier in the, you know, it's like, oh, it's all easy. But I think if you want to be able to maintain and figure out how to evolve and figure out how to, then I think then that stuff just does not serve you well.
Look at the lead singer of Alice in Chains,
Lane Staley, right?
I mean, like, fucking genius, dude. Like, his voice is beautiful. Like, you listen to those old MTV Unplugs and you hear his voice, he's like this, and it's the shit that comes out of it, you're like, unbelievable. Like, he died of fucking heroin and, you know, and all that. It's like, you know, I don't know.
So you were lucky that you just didn't have that gene.
Yeah, my dad's an alcoholic. He's been sober for, I don't know, over 40 years. But for me, like, I can go have a glass of wine and not want another one.
Mm-hmm. What do you think your biggest struggles are?
Vagina. No, I think committing to one girl is really difficult for me.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like really, like, because I love being alone. I love traveling. I love meeting people. And it's not even about wanting to have sex with other girls anymore. I'm not at that place, but I want to go out and hang out with them. And I feel like if you kind of flirt and kiss or touch, you know, another girl, like your girlfriend or wife will be like, that's not cool.
Yeah, that's definitely not cool.
Yeah, but it's not about having sex. It's about a connection with other people. But for me is like, you know, everyone's saying, oh, you got to have a kid. You got to just settle down with one. You know what I mean? And I'm sure, like, if I see you in a year from now or whatever, and I've had a kid and blah, 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 I'll be like, Chris, remember I was saying that thing? I did it. And it's fucking awesome. Why did I wait so long? That's what everyone says.
Yeah.
You're married with kids and all?
No, I'm not.
Really?
Yeah, no.
So you don't have a girlfriend or anything?
Well, Lydia Hurst.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But it's new. We've only been dating for a couple months, and it's not, you know.
Yeah, newly.
We don't have any kids yet.
Right.
That you know of.
Not.
Yeah.
But everyone.
How
does,
old are you? How old are you?
43.
43. Okay. Yeah.
Everyone says that, like, oh, when you have the kids, it's the greatest thing ever. But then with a lot of my friends who actually,
and they're like,
are raising kids, are like,
no,
you get to sleep in,
right?
Run, leave this place.
Okay. And it's funny because can you please chime in on this? I mean, do you have any babies?
No, okay.
No, but it's always the girls. It's always the girls that are always the ones that say you got it. Da 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 da. Like guys are like. Mostly go, don't do it, right?
Well, every time I describe my weekend to the writer's room, which we have three very new parents in the writer's room, they're like,
the guys are into it,
right? What is that like? It must be amazing to not have kids.
Oh, they're like, no, they don't want it, right?
No. Because, like, I just
yeah,
don't.
It's fucked up. It's like a scam for chicks. Right? It's like, come on, come in my vagina. Come on. Let's do it. Have a baby. You know?
Right here.
I don't think I've ever orgasmed in a girl's vagina. Maybe once, like when I was 26 or something.
It's a lot of fun.
I just get scared.
Yeah, because if you...
Pregnancy.
Sure.
And they're like, oh, I'm on the pill. Yeah, right, bitch. You know what I mean? Or you know
probably
what, I mean?
What What's-Her-Face said to Spade.
Yeah. Oh, what's her name?
I forget.
Yeah.
I just don't... I don't know. Maybe if it happens, I'll...
Well, you obviously have some fucking issues too, pal.
Because I don't want...
Well, you're 43, and you've obviously gone out with girls, and for whatever reason, you haven't bungee jumped into the fucking commitment kids and the whole deal.
Absolutely.
So what's going on with you?
I don't know. I think it probably... I mean, I was pretty messed up until I was about 31, and then...
Messed up meaning what?
Just drinking.
Oh, okay, yeah. And now you're sober?
Yeah, for 11 years.
Wow.
And
so you should go to the AA meeting at the store.
That would be a good
one
to go to.
So you were getting really fucked up, huh?
Yeah.
Really?
But a lot of it was because I wasn't comfortable with myself, and I didn't want to have any responsibility.
But you can't have a drink now? You don't want a glass of wine? If you go out with your friends, you have a steak, you're like, oh, do you want one glass of wine? No?
No.
Really?
It's a decaf coffee.
Because you're going to want to keep going?
That's right.
Really?
I'm able to not drink because I respect the power of my addiction, and I know that... And then I go, okay, I could do that, but then where does that lead? And then I see this desolate wasteland that would ultimately happen. I go, well, I don't want that. So I'm going to keep making this choice
I
feel happy.
So do you feel it's like something that's in your system? It's kind of like a disease, right? Don't they call it a disease?
Yeah, but the thing with the brains that we have, I don't mean you, the
alcoholics,
people who drink, is that, we have obsessive brains. Mm. And so it's not like just not drinking makes everything perfect. You know, there's still a lot of shit.
Is there a way that you can get a surgery where they go in there and they tweak your brain so you could just have a couple glasses and not want to?
You know, everyone's brain has a switch where you... No.
No, but wouldn't that be cool?
No, because it doesn't... Like, now it doesn't really mean anything to me anymore. And I don't really... And I also came to appreciate enjoying experiences... The way that
sober.
They are, as
sober.
Opposed to trying to enhance them chemically and kind of faking the amp up, you know.
Oh, I understand.
And so I get that there are probably times where if I had a drink, it'd be like, this party's 10 times more amazing. Right. It's 40% better than it would have been.
Right.
But I also know that having that isn't worth, you know, the 90% drop in the quality of the long-term outcome of the rest of my life. So, that's sort of the math of it. So but your biggest struggle, you think, is commitment?
Um,
I don't know. I just kind of like being alone. And then if you're with a girl, they always want to do shit.
Well, preach, brother.
You know, like, I want to come, even like, I want to come over, and you're like, no, I just want to sit here alone.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to wake up to you in the morning.
Someone say that's maybe a little more of a self-centered take on it, which is fine. Like, you can do whatever you want. Like, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do.
Right.
But maybe do you think it's that you just haven't met the person that makes you want to not?
No. I'm so used to kind of being alone that I really like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like, you know, having companions too, but I also really like going home alone and just being alone and you know, and working on my stuff, you know, or whatever.
What do you do? What do you do when you're alone? Like, what do you do when you go home? What's your kind of ritual?
Well, I usually, from here, I'm going to go to the Korean spa. No, I'm not going to get a hand job. No. Bobby Lee turned me on to this Korean spa that I go to.
Wait, Bobby Lee turned you on to it, and you're sure you're not getting a hand job?
It's not.
Maybe from Bobby.
Yeah, from Bobby, of course.
Is it Wee Spa?
No, it's not Wee Spa. It's a private spa. White people don't know about it.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just I'll go there. I'll shave. I'll watch the game. I'll steam. I'll go into the cold plunge and the hot water, and I'll do that for maybe like 45 minutes. And then I'll go to Silver Lake. And then tonight, my girlfriend's probably going to want to come over. She'll come over. And then... probably there's a local bar down the street that does wine. Maybe have a glass of wine, maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
Probably maybe watch some CNN or like Fox News Channel Surf, you know. Just go to, you know, see Sports Center.
Was any of this been in the documentary? Has the documentary been more focused on you touring?
The documentary is about it's me on a Midwestern tour playing these obscure markets as I'm dealing with my mom kind of moving out of the house. You know, we kind of find out who my mom is in the doc, that she's not just my mom, she's the mom for all these comedians.
Yeah.
So that's revealed because she's in her 80s now. A lot of the younger generation, they don't know who she is.
Sure.
So we talk about all that and then, you know, moving her out of the house of 40 years. So it's kind of like me going out on the road, making a living while I'm dealing with this kind of, I don't want to say secret, but this issue that I have to deal with, which is moving her out of this house of 40 years. It's my childhood house.
This is the house that's like above the Comedy Store?
No, it's the house on Doheny and Sunset.
Oh, okay.
Up there. And that's the house that all the comics that you were talking about earlier would go and party in and get fucked up. And Richard Pryor and Sam and Robin Williams used to pick up his check there. And, you know, this was like my mom. My mom would always be like, after the show, come, let's party at the house. That was my childhood house. So we had to sell it because she's sick and we couldn't afford, you know, and she didn't need to stay there and all that stuff. So I was dealing with that while I was on the road. So it's like something like someone in their 40s really relates to.
And I think
that's why people really responded to the documentary, because everyone is like,
the mortality of their parents.
Yeah, dude, it's fucking gnarly, dude. Like, I stop by there almost every day and she's dying of Parkinson's. It's like she's got this shit in her system and it's just fucked up. It's like a slow death.
How are you holding up?
It's tiring. It's fucking tiring. You know what I mean? But I know at the end of the day, like, I know she's not suffering, meaning she's not in pain. It's not like she's like, like she's got good help.
Mm-hmm.
And Parkinson's, as you know, you can live with forever. Michael J. Fox has it for a while. Muhammad Ali has it. There's a lot of people that have it as long as you have good care.
Yeah.
So she's got good care. So
is she
aware?
Yeah.
Not really. It's gotten worse. Your grandparents still alive?
My have a grandmother still alive, and she doesn't know. She has forgotten that my grandfather died, and she thinks that he's just not coming to pick her up.
Right.
Like, so she's 93 maybe, and so she's definitely suffered.
Yeah.
Some.
And where is she, in Louisville?
No, she's in Northern California.
Oh, Northern California.
Yeah, Bay Area.
So it's it's something that, you know, people in their 40s, 50s, whatever they're experiencing right now. And it's like, you want to do it right and you want to, you know, take care of them. And it's like, so, you know, I'm the baby and I love my mom so much. You know what I mean? And she gave so much to me. She gave so much to the world that I want to make sure she's handled properly. So.
And are you... are your other siblings, do you guys all sort of trade off?
They don't live here, but they, you know, help out emotionally and they call her and blah, blah, blah. But I'm the one that's on the ground, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm here.
And are you are you sort of ultimately prepared with, you know, like, well, she's not
good. Yeah, I mean, pretty much. I mean, I've already kind of said my goodbyes to her just because, like, she hasn't been her in years. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, the yeah. Mitzi Shore, the mom that I knew. So, like, she's just, like, this person that's I don't really recognize as much, you know?
Yeah.
The good part is, though, is a lot of the comics, they do go and visit her. So, like, Arsenio will stop by about a month ago. Gary Shanley stopped by. So, like, I connect with the comics to kind of be the liaison so they can go see her and visit her. And if there's any comics listening, text me, and I'll let you go see my mom. So
that's nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's cool.
So you're dealing with that on the road during this tour.
Yeah, and yeah, on the documentary. So
are you do you talk about it on stage at all?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I talk about it on stage.
It's therapeutic, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the documentary is hugely therapeutic because I shot it at a time where I was fucking shit was heavy for me.
Yeah.
Now stuff's not as heavy for me. Like, I was living in that house, too. Do you understand? So I'm living in the house that's fucking decaying. She's decaying. I'm fucking exhausted. I'm making, you know what I mean? I'm in and out of the road trying to make ends meet, you know, doing my thing, you know, on the road. And I go home, you know, a lot of people go home to like this happiness, like, oh, my wife and kids or my place on the beach. Or like, I'm going home to this death, you know what I mean? And I wanted to film it because I felt like, I don't know, I felt like a musician that was kind of had to sing a sad song, you know what I mean? Like, I had to film it because I was just going through it, and I that was all the stuff that I brought out on the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know?
So in a way, this is kind of a, is this preserving anything for you? I mean, like, was that part of the need to document
it? Yeah, that house and that time, yeah, you know? And I filmed it, and I have it, and I always have it. So
yeah.
It's cool, yeah. And a lot of the comics will see this, and or they have seen it. Like, Louis Anderson texts me, and this one texts me, and like, oh, you know. So it's cool. That was the house.
Yeah.
So, and it's fucking dirt lot now.
It's
crazy. Yeah.
Raised it.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. Well, I would have. I mean, if I bought it, I would have made it a dirt lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it was old and moldy and crusty, and she didn't keep it up.
It almost could have been a comedy museum.
Yeah, it could have been like
a bunch of comics did coke off this table,
yeah,
right here.
Exactly. Well, they have that at my house. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm just kidding.
You got the coke table.
So, do you, in general, do you feel okay now? You feel good?
Yeah, definitely. Except for, you know, the sadness of my mom.
Of course.
But besides that, you know, things are cool, you know?
Well, who do you
I'm back with my old agents, and things are good, you know? Adam Bennett, what's up, bro?
Yeah, I know Adam.
Yeah, so Adam's been my agent for the last couple of years, and, you know, he watches out for me over there, and I'm happy with the stuff that I'm putting out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm really proud of myself. I'm proud of, you know, taking time with things, don't just putting them out. And, you know, I love to create, you know what I mean? That's what I get off on, just like you. You know, you've created this big Nerdist empire. Like, I think that's fucking awesome. Like, I hear about it all the time, and I'm so proud of anyone, you guys that do this stuff. It's like,
well, there was, you know, for the longest time.
No, I know it took you a while.
But there was this, I always felt like there was this, and maybe it was just a self-imposed curse, but I felt like if you worked at MTV, it meant that you, and you were the exception. There were one or two exceptions, but you wouldn't be able to work anywhere else. It was sort of like this weird sort of curse, like, oh, that's an MTV person, and they couldn't. And then at a certain point, I was like, oh, I think I made it. Maybe I made that up in my brain.
I think, honestly, Chris, it's really, to me, it's about the talent. And the talent and the drive and the vision. And I think talent always wins. You know, I think that, you know, musicians, actors, comedians, if you're talented, look at Howie Mandel is a great example of a guy that I think is really super talented. And he was working so well in the 80s. And then for like years, like, he couldn't get arrested. And then he got a deal or no deal. And then all of a sudden people are like, I love Howie. And then he's doing shit with Jay Leno. And then he's doing this and that. And, you know, he's talented, you know, and in Travolta, the same thing. Like, you know. So you're a talented guy, and you had to find your thing, and you found it, and it's cool, you know. So.
It was fun though. Like the experience was really fun.
Trying to figure it out.
No, the MTV experience was. Oh. It was even though I.
You're like no.
When I look back on it, I remember at the time I wasn't enjoying it because I felt out of place. But when I look back, I'm like. You know, it was actually, it was fine. Like, it was a fun...
No,
was,
you did good. I remember I used to watch you on that show. You did a great job.
I don't know. The MTV of it all was sort of a strange... It's different now. They're so different now.
Yeah. Well, the thing that you're doing is like MTV was back then, which is the freedom... To do what the fuck you want to do, uncensored. And MTV was uncensored.
That's what was
so great about it. You know what I mean? Like the shit that I was doing, you know, they never stopped me. They never said anything. I could do whatever I want, just like you could do whatever you want now.
So what kinds of things do you want to continue to work on? Or like, what do you want to do from?
Well, I have this new structure of a new podcast over at Podcast One, which I'm excited about because the podcast that I've had up for a while, which is called Polishers Interested, was actually really cool and different. The way it worked was I'd interview someone. Like, for instance, I'd interview you, and I'd take that interview to Kennedy, mm-hmm. right? And then me and Kennedy would listen to the audio of your interview, and we'd stop it every 5 minutes and kind of comment on what you just said.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So it's like almost like director's commentary on a thing.
Right.
So I had everyone on it. I had I interviewed Kitty Bruce, the daughter of Lenny Bruce, mm-hmm. and then Mark Maron comment on that.
How was that?
It was sick, dude. Like, I learned a lot about Lenny Bruce because Mark Maron really knows a lot about him. And the cool part about that particular episode is the episode wasn't about Mark. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was about Lenny Bruce.
Was he
Bruce.
Okay with that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know.
I'm kidding.
No, but that's what was... Yeah, but it's true. It was... But, you know, I interviewed Chris Rock and then Tommy Davidson comments. So that was that structure. So this new structure that I'm going into now over at Podcast One is more of like my documentary.
Right.
More of like that. You know what I mean? And there's going to be a guest, but it's more about my personal life.
Right.
You know, I'll have my mom's caregiver on. Mm-hmm. I'll check in with her and more like, you know, I'll have my girlfriend on, you know, and see how that goes.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to go. But like how I really am when I'm not filming. That's how I'm going to shoot it.
And I think that's good. I mean, like, I think it is fun to be stupid and it is fun to be that guy that people expect you to be. But I honestly, I think it's okay just to
be,
just
real.
To be this guy. Yeah, like, just to talk and share your feelings and talk about, you know, like what you're.
Are Nerds have big penises, I heard. You know what I mean?
100% true.
Huge dicks.
100%
what?
True.
Ridiculous, like.
They do, right?
Tentacle style. Huge,
it's
prehensile.
Like if you the look curse at a nerd, nerd. No, yeah. If you look at a nerd's glasses, like your glasses, you know, have that big piece of tape right in the middle, there.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it's like the nerds that have the biggest piece of tape are the ones with the bigger penis. So you have a really big penis.
That's the nerd version of plumage. Like that's how you know that their genes are
fertile females now.
Are you afraid of has since you've been around a lot of death
vaginas?
Vaginas.
Yeah. Right.
And you're going through this with your mom now. Are you afraid of it, or are you comfortable with it, or are you
with death?
Yeah,
I'm not afraid of it, and I think about it sometimes, and I think that, like, you know what, if I did die tomorrow, I feel like I did a lot. You know, like I accomplished a lot and went to a lot of places and had a good time. So I figure, like, you know, I did it, but like I want to do a lot more.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So, but I think it's all right. Have you been to Thailand?
No.
You got to go.
Why?
I went this year. It's awesome.
What'd you do?
I don't know. Just had fun. It's just super cheap and the food is super good and people are super nice and the fruit is super juicy. When you bite into like a watermelon here, it's like good.
Yeah.
Or in Hawaii, it's like even better. But over in Thailand, it's like, oh my God.
It's a flavor blast.
Yeah, exactly.
I would love to. There are so many places that I mean, Thailand sounds interesting. There
you should
are places
do your
that I would
nerdist,
love to go
your
first.
Nerdist podcast from Thailand, dude.
I want to go to. Bring I want to go to Tokyo like a, first. I think sure. I think South Korea would be really fun.
Yeah,
I want to go to Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
you know.
You're probably big over there with this, right? What are the numbers?
In Iceland?
Five, over in Iceland?
Two.
Five, maybe 12.
five to 12.
Have you been overseas with your stuff?
No.
You should.
I mean, I've done stand-up in London, but that's it.
Really?
Yeah.
When was that?
About a year.
And they knew you from all your stuff?
They just knew the podcast.
Wow. Didn't we decide that it would make sense for us to do a podcast over there, but we never
did. I think you would be great over there.
Yeah, we could. I don't know if it would make sense.
That's all we need to do.
It's very expensive.
Just break even.
Yeah, as long as we could break even, it would be
fine. So you make money off of this?
Well, yeah, now.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But not thousands.
Shit tons.
Not shit tons.
But do you, like, pay for this room?
Yeah.
For the people that don't know what the Nerdist, do you do this every week in this particular room?
This is one of our studios.
This is one of the studios.
First of all, it's not a studio. It's a fucking room.
It's an office.
It's not even an office. It's a room that you'd put like VHS copies of like old shit.
Yes,
in.
It's a storage room that they cleared out so we could do the podcast in.
They're like, oh, let's stick them over here.
We threw out 25 years of Johnny Carson's Tonight Show because that was all the tapes that were in here. We threw those out.
Well, I mean, the sort of the way that it works now is because we produce so many other shows, and because we like the company, we have about 30 employees. Like, it's not like I'm making so much money from this podcast. It's like it's just part of the thing. It's part of all the stuff.
It's the profitable part of the machine.
It's part of everything that we do.
And you have a whole bunch of your podcasts on your network.
Yes,
that's sick.
Yeah,
that's sick.
It's fun. It's really
that's
fun.
Great.
I like it. Anything else you want to plug before we? Before we...
My penis in your butt.
Okay. We're going to see that in a minute. Is there a social media?
Well, is she looking?
Instagram,
what's
Matt?
Going on with the ratings? What do you...
It's pretty far down there.
It's pretty far down. How?
That's okay. Hey, Iceland, put down those fucking ice picks.
Oh, I was actually surprised to see us in Hungary.
There's a lot of pussy in Hungary, bro. You should go out there. Tell Lydia. Yo, babe, I'm doing a remote mobile over there, babe. You got to stay home.
I am a monogamous creature.
Yes.
I don't really care about...
I'm kidding.
No, of course you are. But I honestly don't really care about fooling around that much. Like, I just don't really care.
I understand.
You know what it is? Because...
Stop winking at me, bro. What
the
hell?
Like...
It's like, I don't care. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Stop recording.
Yeah.
I don't really care about it because it creates issues and expectations, and then people's, you know, like your feelings can get hurt, someone else's feelings.
So you're
can
saying
get hurt.
I shouldn't cheat on my girlfriend tonight?
You should probably not cheat on your girlfriend tonight.
Okay.
But ultimately,
especially if she's coming over.
That would be the main reason not.
You know what's fucked up about her is the first time we hooked up was me, her, and her girlfriend.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? So she's that type of girl, but now like you turned into the girlfriend mode, and like they're like, "What are you looking at?" Like, ugh.
So it's not. So it's you not like you feel like it started one way, and now it's transitioned
to. They all do.
It's transitioned
into her in the rompers with her mud mask on. How do I look, honey? No, I'm just kidding. She's not like that.
you're just kidding with sort of half. I'm just kidding. sort of just kidding. But it was good to see you, and it was nice catching up. And
yeah, dude, I'm so proud of you. Like, I love when people do well.
Oh, thank you.
You know what I mean? I know how hard it is, and I know that, you know, you're out there. You guys are out here in this broom closet slaving away. But can you plug my stuff so people, all your nerds can come over to
my
side?
Yes.
Can they come over to my side a little bit?
They can come to your side.
Dude, because you're the king nerd, bro. Tell them to shoot fly over to the Wii side, bro.
That wouldn't come out of my mouth. In a way
that's
that would
how you'd
be
say it.
Discernible.
You'd say she'd fly over to the Wii set.
Yeah. See, it sounds good coming
exactly
out of you.
Twitter at Pauly Shore, and then the new podcast is going to be at Podcast One, and the new documentary is on Showtime, and it's playing all month.
And what's it called?
It's called Pauly Shore Stands Alone, but I'm not standing alone, bro. I'm with Super Nerds.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm with Super Nerds. New Super Nerds power, want to activate.
But you like being alone.
Yeah, I like being alone.
But still, it's go cool. Watch his stuff, please.
But go watch his stuff.
Yeah.
Alone. Enjoy your burrito.
Later, dudes.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Are you tired of dating assholes? Do you want a Prince Charming? If so, we're filming a reality show. Sign up here.
12 American women are flown over to the UK for a bachelor-style reality dating show.
There are so many questions about a show like this because it's so odd.
These women have been told that they were going to be dating the world's most eligible bachelor. Prince Harry.
What? Y'all playing with me, right?
You can binge The Bachelor of Buckingham Palace exclusively on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts or the Wondery app.